big part of my practice. And I have this, I have two manuscripts, besides that manuscript, which feels like kind of like that's my thinky thing. Then I have these two other manuscripts that are kind of like in competition. There's like the main one, it's called Consumes Me, and that's like with the Belladonna Chapel, there's an excerpt of that. And that took me, it's been like 9 years of like doing these events, these actions, these instigations, which turns into installations, and basically like I went from being like a poet and a video artist to like an interdisciplinary artist. And it's been like a really intense process. And I really need to finish that thing, but it's like the intensity of it is like I cheat on it with this other manuscript that I'm going to read a section of, and I don't know what to say about it. I mean, it's a lot about dogs and animality and relationality, and yeah, that's all. And I won't say it has a working title, but I really hate it. If anybody has an idea for this section of the titles, I'm really open to hearing it. I have a title for the whole manuscript, and I really love it. Someone told me that it was bad luck to tell the title of like the manuscript in progress, and so I'm really superstitious, so no one can know. Last summer, a woman I knew invited me and most of the people I know to an inlet of land off the Bell Parkway called Plum Beach to count mating horseshoe crabs. The invite read, "Witness the once-a-year full moon mating ritual of the horseshoe crab in Jamaica Bay. See and touch these ancient creatures as they crawl ashore at high tide. Find your spirit animal seaside with the help of a shaman. Pace the edge of the waterline with scientific experts as the full moon rises over the ocean." So on that day, Nick and Brock and I rode the A-train for a really long time, occasionally asking each other why we were going, listing bullet points, but still far from an answer besides the fact that it was a beautiful Sunday. A precarious mantle, a nice thing to do on a Sunday. That thing about the shaman and spirit animal sounds like a nice thing to do on a Sunday. Once, another evening before this one, the inviting woman told me she thought that I especially needed to meet this shaman. That night, the conversation kept pointing back to this place, a place I used to live and now often comes up in conversation where I now live, as a place people imagine to be a lot easier. This place we live in is so hard, and that place would be so much easier, they imagine. When this happens, people often ask about my time in that place. They find it so fascinating that I came back to this place, this awful place. Often I pedal back from those conversations to cover up the dread I feel towards that place, and if I'm really honest, my desire to escape that brought me there. My pat answer for this situation is usually, "I'm not really the best person to ask. Check it out for yourself, but don't move there." This response never accomplishes what I want. People tend to push for more. Like this night, this is what the woman did, so I felt cornered as I explained to her what this place represents to me. That place, a land of knee-jerk response and self-satisfaction, impressions collaged together to build a cut-and-paste culture to wipe out anything complicated, denying any space to say anything as if erasing the problems wasn't a more problematic position. This woman told me that she felt a soul renewal was in order for me, as if my soul was tarnished by myself or this place. That part was unclear. But I wanted to clear this frustration with myself for thinking a place would have an answer, so I was interested. After the train, we proceeded in a car to a blip off the highway, a path to a beach. Later, my friend Amal tells me that Plum Beach used to be a very popular spot for gay cruising because the shore was blanketed by overgrown bushes. Now the bushes were all cut down, and we met up with others that some of us knew and others didn't, standing in a parking lot with the same expression of "what am I doing here" on their faces. The only ones who seemed to know what was going on were the scientists, who kept thanking us for coming and taking all our information down in clipboards. Off to the side, I saw a woman about my age wearing a long flowing skirt that screamed, "Hey, I'm the shaman." Her hair was long and free, and at closer look, she seemed about 12. Once we were all collected, she led us onto the beach and asked us to lie down on the sand in a circle and imagine a place in nature that makes us feel safe. Can you tell me a place in nature that makes you feel safe? I chose the place behind my mother's house. I saw boats, a picnic table, an abandoned theater. The shaman told us to dig a hole in that place so that we could climb down into our mind. She told us to pay attention to everything, to use our imagination. That word, imagination, always connects me to the naive, so I think this is why my first draft of an animal came out kind of cartoonish, like a street artist drawing in a tourist attraction. I imagined a cat of human size wearing a button-down shirt, gingham, and khaki pants, a belt and the shirt tucked in like a very old man. So that's exactly who I meet when I finish climbing down the hole, but we both know that's not right. He's not the animal I'm looking for. He tells me I'm only a figment of your imagination, then looks down at himself and shrugs and says, not bad. Then he led me down a hallway where behind every corner was a dog. Every dog I ever cared for when I used to work as a dog walker. And then there's a door at the end of the corridor, and I know before I open it that I will see my dog Thurston. But this also feels too obvious. Even when it happens, we open the door and there he sits on his hind quarters looking slightly bored. I tell myself to believe that this is when he can speak. We're not here to be our normal selves. I have to trust that he has something to say to me. So I ask him what it is, and he tells me, you have to learn how to not give yourself away. Make them love you, but don't let them have you. And then he scratched his face with his back leg for a second and drank in a very deep yawn. Then he continued, this is not the same thing as not speaking your mind. State exactly what you think, tell them what you need, but they don't have you. They can never hold you. The objective is to map the field of desire, given that the desire is positive. We take positive to mean that it exists, that it is present and not absent, and that it can be positioned. For example, many desires result in what we feel are negative outcomes. Observe a given. The given could be a situation, a feeling, a problem. Anything that can be observed is given, absolute. The given may be something that was given previously. Be careful to separate observation from evaluation. For example, if it's raining, I could whine, it's not supposed to rain. You would hear it in my voice, but it's absolutely raining. If I feel bad, I can't say I shouldn't feel bad. I just feel bad, so I make that sound to let you know. I'm not happy about the rain. Now, position desire. This may be in the form of a question, command, request, or simply those things you call words. The desire may be directly related to the given, the results of cause and effect, or a subconscious trigger. For example, sometimes when I feel bad, I pant. I would like water. Or given that I feel bad, I desire to run in the grass, kind of like now. But we are only surrounded by dirt, so I will dig a hole instead until I feel better or sufficiently dirty, whichever comes first. Then he stopped to dig a hole with his front paws. His concentration was remarkable in its focus. He took his time with the digging until he was sufficiently calmed. Then he shook himself free from the dirt with moderate success and continued. The desire may be realized immediately, positioned in a now possible future. To map a field of desire, one treats the difference between what you have and what you want as a problem of connection. From here, we can map trajectories, patterns, behaviors, intersections, alignments, making it possible for one desire trajectory to activate another desire trajectory. Developing the practice entails the establishment of a resonant frequency between the desires of two or more beings, or in individual cases, your desires and your environment, without resorting to guilt, threat, or coercion. The structure and language allow for the greatest possibility for interpretation and desire in relation to actual environment. Is a feedback loop that hypothesizes that one's choice of a given reality determines the possibilities and outcomes of desire. I'm not really sure how long we lay there. When we're asked to wake, I realize my body matches the coolness of the sand. We shake out our stopped blood. The shaman asks if anyone wants to share, and the only person who speaks is the lead scientist. She has something to say in regard to something that was said before we began to sink into our holes. There had been a group meditation. In the shaman's guided meditation, she stated something to the effect that we should send our worries to the sea, and this was something that the scientists took issue with. She felt it was important to remind the group that we didn't have the right to throw anything into the sea. Ever. The shaman was threatened and did very little to hide it. The fact that our spiritual leader and a science specialist had an inability to understand each other kind of unraveled the moment. It unraveled the night. These politics landed like a stink bomb over the sand and made people shift their weight and look out into the sky. Too vulnerable we were from the devastating and accumulated in our bodies. We are not Teflon, but we could have moved on. But neither the scientist or the shaman took the lead to hear each other, so things became awkward. Our spiritual leader couldn't perform compassion, and the scientist seemed too comfortable on the high ground. So there we were, processing vulnerability as it mutated before our eyes into disposability. I think most of us were there for the spirit, but our leader on that front wasn't as authoritative in the way most of us needed. Before we hit the beach, the woman who had brought us here, or brought me here, felt it was important to tell me that the shaman was a former dominatrix. And that her spiritual practice was also an extension of that. At a loss by what the woman's intention was in telling me this fact, I just chose to ignore it until now. Because all I saw was a woman putting on a costume and performing a script to allow someone to feel like they weren't really in control. They didn't have to have all the answers. But there was a pleasure in floating above the ground and letting go of everything, giving the moment their time to someone else to manage, saying, trust me, it's yours, and I'm simply a conduit, one of many escalating within the confines of the boundary that you create. The levels of restriction on the clothing differed, but the shaman gave some kind of the same thing. Connecting these dots gave me some insight, empathy, but also suspicion. Still, people believed. My friend Sabine came running up to me and told me that she was a rooster. Her wide and watery grin conveyed an enthusiasm that reminded me of that childlike quality that only I would be able to hold on to. During this time, the science crew circled up with their clipboards for a bit, and then the science lady returned to explain the purpose of why we were there, the real reason. On the night of the full moon, the horseshoe crabs meet along the eastern seaboard to mate, a ritual for millions of years. And she was part of an organization that counted how many came up to the shore to keep track of the population. As she explained this, suddenly I loved her, this passion so totally hers, infectious. It made me think of things that gave me a feeling of purpose. I wanted to be as present to those things as she was to this camp. We divided into various working groups. Some held tape measures and some were responsible for counting, one group for male crabs and one for the females. Not everyone in the group had a role in the counting. There were way more of us than needed, and I just wanted to observe, so I stepped away. Others had already petered out, the ones that had taken acid, but those still standing fell into a flow, following my counter and watching, talking. I decided to walk with the shaman. The others, my friends, couldn't stop bad-mouthing her. By standing with them, I wasn't sure if I was being fair. I started the conversation by telling her how I thought my dog was my spirit guide in the beginning of the exercise, and without even giving this a thought, she simply agreed with me that it must be them, in kind of a sage way, which just kind of made me really mad at her. It reminded me, probably because I'm thinking of a late night email conversation with my friend T, who had asked me to participate in a performance that involved a seance. They wanted me to write in the space and have me and my dog Thurston there as the representation of a maternal connection. Thurston and I were still recovering from the emergency room that he almost didn't survive, so I asked them, why Thurston? They answered back in an email, because you're so connected with him. Of course, you don't have to bring him, you could do something else, but it is that exact thing, that material and spiritual connection, and dare I call it companionship, that extends between worlds that made me think you two would be good for this piece. That and something in his eyes, but I totally understand that he's not up for it. Perhaps you can think of another simple reproductive task or action that has us feel. When we have a conversation, we decide not to do it. Maybe Thurston stays home, we think of something else. Just so you know, this is still tea. Just so you know, I see you and Thurston and your relationship as a spiritual force in its own right. No ritual required. Seance, in its etymology, simply means sitting or session. There are things much deeper than art and ritual. Then again, art and ritual have the power to compose healing. Still, this is an experiment, and perhaps it's better not to take chances. Much love, T. When the woman had told me about the shaman's previous employment, I immediately thought of a friend I once had who was a dog for several years until she retired and decided to manage an S&M club in the East 30s. Sometimes she would call me in the middle of the night to come over to the dungeon and share a bottle of champagne. One night I took her up on her offer. One of the clients liked to come by and present her with a bottle of champagne to watch her drink it. It had become their ritual. She described this as we waited for his arrival. She made it sound so normal. And when he arrived, they greeted each other like old friends, making small talk about traffic and weather. Once his jacket was off, he went straight to the task and grabbed for the bag and the bottle. My friend became rigid and said no, and then pointed over at me, smoking a cigarette and sitting on the black leather couch, observing the scene like an audience member seated at a play. Present it to her. He immediately turned and walked towards me and then got down on his knees. Would you like me to open it? Sure, but I need to ask you something. What is it? Why do you do this? I don't understand. Why do you enjoy this? He took a minute to untwist the muslin cage that held the cork into the bottle, and then he seemed to understand my question. When I was married, my wife and I used to fight all the time. It got to be the only way I felt connected to anything was when she was yelling at me, and now she's gone. He paused, then said, I just really miss her, and then he popped the cork. I guess this is why I expect a little bit more from the empathetic gesture of the shaman than post-ritual agreements. It's just a little bit more work than wearing a skirt. But maybe this interaction with the shaman was just showing me what Thurston really meant. Somewhere along the way in this conversation with the shaman, she figured out I was the one who was in need of a soul renewal, according to our mutual acquaintance. Then I could see the hustle stream out of her, how she was the only one that could really see what I needed, how I should set up a time to consult with her more about this. She had very negotiable rates. I drifted back to my friends without saying anything else because that was the last straw, the trap back into the transactional. The counting continued, but the majority of us just walked. We kept going not because it gave us a sense of purpose, but more because there was nothing else to do, similar to the resolve that one must take when they find that they're stranded on the side of the road with nothing else to do but stand. We moved also because it was freezing. The crowd slowly gathered, emphasis on slow. Since the weather was stormier than expected, so it seemed like many of the ladies decided to stay in. It was easy to identify the female. She was much larger and sank herself into the sand, waiting to be straddled. The males were considerably smaller and scurried around on the banks looking for a lady. Like most bars, this beach was swarming with men, and much of our dialogue with the counters and walkers was focused on that and wishing them luck. Even going so far as to pick them up and point them in the right direction, as if to pass along some sort of interspecies karmic debt. Along the way, I reconnected with someone I used to know from that place I used to live. We had dated the same girl in that place. Now her new girlfriend is in a band with my former best friend. The last time I saw her, she gave me a pair of noise-canceling headphones. Another woman I think is her girlfriend is silent and cold. We all want to go home. We try not to focus on that by making small talk. She just got back from visiting that place we used to live, and she tells me that there are all these great new bars. I say something about how that always seems to be what people focus on in that place, the drinking, where you go to drink. She seemed confused, wondered if I was actually happy here, which felt so funny to be asked on this dark and freezing beach, so far from what you imagine when you think of life in the city. And I said, yes, more than anything you know, I have to admit I don't think of that other place. I don't think much of that other place, never really have. Our trusty science pack leader interrupts this conversation I don't want to have by asking us if anyone wants to pick up a few of the male crabs so they can feel what is underneath their slimy shells. We say yes and slowly graze our fingers over their wriggly tarantula-like legs. Touching something so alien and other reminds me of an interview I once read with Drew Barrymore from the 90s. In the magazine, she was wearing a t-shirt that said, "Too fast to live, too young to die." She was leaning against a wall. She was leaning against a wall, smoking a cigarette, and a quote from the interview floated near her head on the page in a serifed font. It said, "I always have to touch the stove to understand the heat." Thank you.
Divya Victor. That's better, right? Is it on? It's on. Can you hear in the back?
No.
Yeah. So, I'm just under talking. So Divya Victor is the author of Kith, which Fence Books published recently, in the last little bit. A book of verse, prose, memoir, lyric, essay, visual objects, and I really hope that after this reading you'll take some time to take up a copy and observe the different kinds of forms that are in it. It's very, very, it ranges widely over different forms. Natural subject, which was the winner of the Bob Talkman Award, Unsub, and Things to Do with Your Mouth from the League. Her chapbooks include Semblance and Holocasts by Charles Reznikoff, by Divya Victor, by Vanessa Place. Her criticism and commentary have appeared in Journal of Commonwealth and Postcolonial Studies, Jacket 2, and the Poetry Foundation's Harriet. Okay, I'm not gonna read the whole bio, even though it is full of things that you would recognize and be interested to know about, including the Journal of Conceptual Writing, the Best American Experimental Writing, and Boundary 2. She's been a Mark Diamond Research Fellow at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, a River Run Fellow at the Archive for New Poetry at University of California, San Diego, and a writer in residence at the Los Angeles Contemporary Exhibit. Her work has been performed and installed for or at Museum of Contemporary Art, MoCA Los Angeles, the National Gallery of Singapore, the Los Angeles Contemporary Exhibit, and the Museum of Modern Art. She's an assistant professor of poetry and writing at Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. Her new project that she's working on, which is front and center on her really cool looking website, which I encourage you to visit also, is called Sugar on the Gash. Of that, she says, "Because before my body took its place in the phenotypic parade, my appearance as South Asian, before my name took its place in the bureaucratic queue, citizenship documents, passports, visas, before I was called a darky in grad school, before I came to identify as an illiterate Tamilian, I first claimed an Anglophone I, that mean and inky bridge from self to self, from inchoate cry to speech, from subject to object and back, is built at the recitative scene in a decolonizing India." Back to me. I know she's going to be reading tonight from Kith, which Fence published, as I said, and is over there. So I'm gonna read a couple of things that people have said about Kith. Douglas Kearney said, This monumental work shifts shapes, not for virtuosity's sake, though virtuosic it is, but as one takes up an array of instruments for an intricate undertaking. Quandary, how not to become a jingle of anklets, the colonizer desires, perhaps by being a jangle of them. Kit is that dissonance composed. It sounds bitter, tender, and utterly necessary. I read an interesting article recently about the use of this word necessary to describe work that, well, poetry and other writing that is political within this moment, like a strange, possibly overuse of that word. But here it's true. Amitaya Kumar said, "For Divya Victor, history is a wound, and the poet's language is bright like the white bandage on which blood shows more clearly. What we have on display in this book is an imagination that is as wide as the world, part anthem, part instruction manual, part memoir, part dictionary. This text offers testimony to other ways of being and remembering, a reflection on forgotten lives." That's part of what she said. Then lastly, Rachel Zolf said, "Kith is a luminous work of multiple telling with multiple offering, as Teresa Hoffkyung Cha might say, the dead flittering out of her thrifted coats with kith in their mouths. Kith, like neighbor, friend, and enemy or community, is a kind of conceptual limit, not of blood and yet belonging, not kin, which it is often confused with, but kindred, kinship, and also knowledge. Yet in kith, it turns out that kith is also kin, and kin is also kith, and the neighbor is also friend, enemy, and the other neighbor's neighbor, and we are all stuck here at the limits of language, grasping for new forms of community and belonging when those words suck too, yet refuse to burn." Please welcome Divya Victor.
Is really a labor of love. It involves answering emails sent in great desperation in the middle of the night, talking poets off the edge, being like, but nobody understands me. It also involves making them cheese sandwiches when they're hungry, and Rebecca has done all of this and more, so this reading is for Rebecca Wolf. Don't know anything about where I come from. My biography is composed in a triptych. I was born in India, and when I was 11, my father left for Singapore in the middle of the night to find work because we looked into our future and could not see it. And he worked in Singapore undocumented, and then my mother and my grandmother and I left in the middle of the night again to follow him. And then we were in Singapore for several years, and then we looked into our future and we couldn't see it. And so my dad did this again when I was 18, and he moved to the United States, and he worked undocumented, and we left in the middle of the night, and we followed him. And so I became here, and came here, and became here. So I've held multiple citizenships. I was Indian, I was Singaporean, and then I became American, which is what I am currently. And throughout these various migrations, all somewhat secretive, and all born out of a kind of reasoning that comes from madness or despair. It is rational, but it comes from madness or despair. Throughout these migrations, I would see people who looked like me on the streets where I lived, in various cities I lived, people who were ostensibly South Asian or Indian. But because I was often a child when I saw them, or because I was often a woman when I saw them, I didn't feel like I could approach them, but I felt this draw, this magnetic familiarity. I just wanted to walk up to them and say, "Are you okay? Are they being good to you here? Are you surviving all right?" But I could never do it. And that uncertainty about my approach, about the feeling of being magnetized towards kith, towards people you feel like you belong to, comes from the fact that I don't know what kith is. It comes from always having to question who those people are, why I'm connected to them, if I'm not of blood, if I'm not of bone. So I want to read from the prologue to this book, Kith, which tries to figure out what that is. And like all definitions that are worth much, I think begins with negation. So thank you for being here to listen to that definition first. Neither your mother, nor your father, nor your sister, nor your brother. Neither your grandmother, nor your grandfather, nor your aunt by blood, nor your uncle by blood. Neither your child, nor your grandchild, nor your great-grandparent, nor your great-grandchild. Neither of this generation, nor the next, nor the one prior. Neither your cousin by blood, nor your cousin by bone. Neither inheriting nose, nor skin, nor brow, nor boat. Neither bestowing flesh, nor tooth, nor hair, nor gait. Neither in a manner of laughing, nor holding a plate, neither descended from, nor descending to, neither named for, nor named after, neither of brood, nor blood, nor stock, nor pool, neither possessing by claim, nor disowned by name, neither baptized at the ancestral font, nor buried in the shared grave, neither living, nor dead, nor born, nor bred, neither passed on nor passing away, neither like nor unlike, nor resembling tissue and cartilage, neither by birthright nor by death rites, nor by divination nor miracle, neither by gene or gestation, neither by womb or tomb, nor cuckold nor platoon, but by what is sensed or seen or heard or felt in what moves between those not of blood and yet belonging together, either on land or in air or in water or in paper, either through name or race or face or place of birth or blame, either as sign or shibboleth or overheard epithet, either as a mark on a forehead or caught in crossheads, either for paycheck or paper, or map or license or visa, either by the queue or queen or quill, either by mandate of state or decree of fate, either in law or labor or abode, either by hell or high water, either by tongue or trade or tendency to wander, either as a manner of walking into rooms or crossing the arms, either by headdress or footwear or part of hair, either by grain or meat or milk or holy book, as the days of the week or the names for the moon, as a manner of love or as a manner of hate, as a manner of leaning or standing erect, either by ritual or by roads taken, by the way something pleats or drapes or hangs or is latent, as a way you move or are at rest by passing or failing another's test, either as a way of knowing or being known, either by the way a we exists or does not when we are not at home, either as targets or by treason, either as a question of resemblance or an answer to a name. Researching migration from the subcontinent, I chanced upon this turn of the century clinic for hysterics in France in Bordeaux, where they had diagnosed several incidents, several patients, with a condition called dromomanie, which is ambulatory automatism. So I would describe what it is using the language of the clinician who invented it, or who found it, discovered it, named it, really. And then I will give you examples of some dromomanie in my family. So these are mostly myths and stories about migration that I have inherited from my grandparents and parents. So the first is the epigraph from the Clinic for Hysterics from 1891. By the term ambulatory automatism, dromomanie, is understood a pathological syndrome appearing in the form of intermittent attacks during which the patient, carried away by an irresistible impulse, leaves her home and makes an excursion or journey justified by no reasonable motive. The attack ended, the subject unexpectedly finds herself on an unknown road or in a strange town. Swearing by all the gods never again to quit her penance, she returns home, but sooner or later, a new attack provokes a new escapade. So that was a medical condition diagnosed in 1891. And these are the contemporary cases. In one such case, a woman was found so forcefully fornicating with her feet, the soil under her, that they thought she was attempting to bury her own body while standing upright. When pressed, she confessed that she had heard of travel and was attempting to push her body through to the other side of the world. There are many such cases. In one such case, a man so beaten by debt, two wives and four girl children menstruating in orchestrated vengeance against the greasy rupees in his pockets, rolled his bedding and straw mat and carried them out of his hut after he'd shat out his gruel and before the cock crowed into the canvas sky. Later, this story was told to four girls, all wives, pulling straw matting and feathers from their cunts, smelling of sleep and gruel, their afterbirth stamped and dated. In one such case, a man was promised a wall made of gold bricks in a land where palm trees bled almond milk and oases of honey pooled wherever one stood, and so he took his passport out of the rinsed milk bag and offered it to an agent who flew him to a desert and left him there where he drank his own piss and never returned until his wife, gone bone dry in waiting, married a man with an identical mustache years later. Later, this story was told by the neighbor of a policeman greased with palmolive margarine and lifting a grinding stone about his head and onto a sleeping infant. These are all those stories. In one such case, a woman embroidering the name of her fourth child into the mantelpiece of tapestry was called by her husband to pickle oil from the Persian Gulf in a city that plotted around an oasis where centuries ago star-crossed lovers failed each other, Layla and Majnun, she dining, waiting, he walking miles and kissing every wall to know if she lived behind it, and from which she would return without her hair and with a spool of black thread to spell again the names of her children. Later, this story was told to other children in a kitchen while smoothing the ruffled mackerel gills and sharpening knives on gray slabs of granite drawn from a quarry where men had fallen over and over in love with their own destinies. In one such case, a woman exchanging aluminum coins for whole mackerel was called by her father through the gardener, who was sent by the scullery maid, who had heard of the family's jeweler that the bloom of gold which secured the daughter's marriage to the man from the land of arrows had heart of wax. And so this woman walked backwards, oily pomfret scales flashing at her gold bangles and pink rose spilling to the earth until she reached the land of arrows and rent each shaft in two and turned wearing fletching in her hair like firecracker flowers. Genus Cassandra, life cycle perennial. And later, there was no later. I grew up with these stories, some horrifying, some extraordinarily entertaining, and some both. You know, imagine being a six-year-old being told that a distant uncle of yours was left in the desert and had to drink his own piss. You're torn between the horror and they said piss. So that I think was a definitive tonality that comes through in some of this book, and I just want to read something that comes from that moment of understanding horror to be rather funny. And of course, as I was growing up in the 80s, horrifying funniness was emblematized in America's Funniest Home Videos. so I want to read from a poem called S is for Saget Bob. And it's part of an abecedarium at the end of the book. It's sort of alphabetical, A is for B is for, etc. And it's me rewriting the alphabet, obviously. And S is for Saget Bob. I fell in love with Bob Saget the same week I decided to trim my eyelashes. I had heard if you cut your hair, it grows back thicker. But if you cut your mouth trying to kiss the TV, your shame grows back thicker. Bob. Bob, you were a whiteness returning home to find your wife. All of America was yours, Bob. In your smart navy blazers and neutral ties, you were like a man in a smart navy blazer wearing a neutral tie. You were as opaque as flannel. There was no entering you. I had no option but to eat you whole. Bob, you were a Christmas special all year round. But you didn't expect this part. And so this is the Christmas special I'm quoting. And what do you want, young lady?
A cat, it wasn't soft.
Oh, how about a bath mat? That's soft.
Oh, Bob.
And here's another lady. Another young lady. Turn around so everyone can see how pretty you are. And what would you like for Christmas?
A baby.
I don't think I can help you with that, but we'll see what we can do. Bob, you're killing me. Thank you. You may sit down, please. Vivia? Vivia, you're kissing the TV again. I would watch you. I would watch you at dinner. And I would soak my puppet arm in the yogurt until they were paler versions of the soft, supple brown things my sharp brown ankles could never imagine on your American television. Cheerleader bumps, dinner bumps, donut crumbs, the mound of a turkey tanning in thanks, Michael Jordan's glossy printed cobs in a grown man's bedroom, the slow motion slump of a hammock soft with a fat so-and-so, and Bob, I would rip you apart, weeping into my curds, and watch how easily things broke on your screen. Kayaks into caravans, kids into cots, yards of crisp wrapping paper shredded by tall six-year-olds in socks, blondes named Kevin or Kyle, small boy birds running screaming from slushy dogs, a drain patch weighed by a Wyoming winter claiming a puffball beanie, and then I would eat you. I would eat you and wash you down with the grainy timestamps and the VHS tapes they all sent in for your love, Bob. I thought you made these things happen. The brightest front rows of enameled teeth and the wide mouths in the front row, this laughter, this short queue of sleepy-hatted black dominoes crashing down on another church pew, the red, the white, the blue, or the funniest thing you do, America, America, I wanted you. So Bob Saget was my introduction to whiteness. But there were other ways that I discovered it as an eight-year-old in India. And so I'll read one more course piece that describes some of that. Y'all are still with me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So this is L for LAX, Los Angeles, to TRV, Trivandrum. economy class. Whiteness first arrived in a Samsonite suitcase traveling from Sacramento to Trivandrum in 1987, when my Indian American family had come to visit my family. Whiteness arrived in baby auntie's copy of Glamour magazine with Cindy Crawford on the cover. Her eyebrows were the brushed out wingspan of a pet eagle, its talons grasping an olive branch and arrows, which happens to be on the state seal. Her earrings were drizzled yellow mustard against a dewy hot dog. Whiteness arrived tucked into the silky puckered compartment where baby auntie had kept her silky puckered things and the saw high boiled sweets that made my mouth into a silky puckered thing as I sat on a parapet swinging my legs in skirts the way one does until one's skirts start filling up with blood. Whiteness arrived as a woman's leg in a red stiletto. It began at a pale, dog-eared knee and ended at a glossy toe, and it was wrapped in a champagne-colored nylon stocking. I borrowed the magazine and I pressed it to my chest. Later, lying on the terracotta terrace, I placed the cool page on my right leg and closed my eyes. The sun's spangles lifted each eyelash like a curtain that would never again fall on my darkness. Which is to say, whiteness wasn't smuggled in, it was given the red carpet. The American dollar arrived that same year. It levitated, scented like cinnamon gum and leather hot for my baby auntie's purse. The budding baby slumdog millionaire in me pressed its creased, greasy flatness between its hands in a fawning namaste that still turns my toes numb in shame. In 1987, one US dollar was worth 13 rupees. One of theirs was worth 13 of ours. Today, one of theirs, of mine, is worth 68 of ours of theirs. When my aunt arrived in India, she was a new brand of Indian, a hyphenated American, as compared to us standard edition Indians, the mere Indians of Kipling, of Tagore, of Merchant Ivory films, of Ben Kingsley wrapped in khadi being photographed by Candace Bergen relaxed in khakis, of National Geographic's sympathetic coverage of our asses hanging low over all the gutters of your Jungle Books. In family photographs, baby auntie's hair is an autumnal bonfire whipped by the wind, and her waistline is crimped by a bright slash of a galaxy I could never read. Her Madras check shift grids her curves, 75% cotton, 25% linen. I squint around the sparks of her halo and I see other women standing in dark silhouette around her, their black hair parted down the middle, curtly tucked behind the ears and pulled into demure braids, leading the eyes to hips wrapped in 4 layers of chiffon or cotton, straddled by my cousin's scabby and ashy legs proudly dangling a worn rubber shoe. The cover of Glamour magazine that baby auntie had purchased for $1.95 at Los Angeles Airport was advertising, quote, great fashion buys under $57. In 1987, $57 was 741 rupees, which would have paid a month's rent and my school fees. The rupee derives from the Sanskrit rupya, which means stamped or impressed in a rupam, a likeness or an image of something else. The rupee was stamped in the image of something else, and the word for money was drawn up feet first from its Dravidian root urupu, which means from the body politic in which flesh is a kind of currency we can use to pay our way into each other's dreams, first spun from 75% cotton and 25% linen, like the American dollar, folded in two and placed in a hot purse scented with cinnamon gum. So I had some strange expectations of America. Most of the cinnamon gum has been a disappointment. But when I did end up coming here, when I was 18, there was no instructional manual, obviously, for cultural assimilation. And so when I was writing this book, I kind of wrote a list of instructions that I wished someone had given me. And this is a section called Paper People, because that is who I come from. We are documented with paper, and we are identified with paper. We are paper people. And it has an epigraph from a movie called Nayagan, a Tamil film. And it's a song composed by Maestro Ilaiyaraaja, and it's written by a lyricist named Pulamai Pithan. I'll sing it in Tamil first, and then I'll translate it for you. How to survive on land if you are made of paper. Then Pandi Chi Mayila, Te Rodum Vidi Yila, Man Pola Vandavani. Dear waxing moon, do not wane, do not even now weep out in pain. If you wail, my heart won't bear it. When you wail, my heart can't bear it. How to survive on land if you are made of paper. Keep variations on an exit handy. Mend the sandals and eat enough dirt to grow accustomed to waiting on new ground. Walk up to strangers with maps and beg an interpretation and ask them to divine your path past the Walmart and into the parking lot where you live in a Toyota catching suitcases unpacking plans. Make of your walk a wall. Make of your arms an armory. Make of a memory nothing but self-same, but in the darkness of movie theaters, memorize the faces with lined eyes, unlined foreheads, untied frenulums, undone sternums. Walk home with the dead flittering out of your thrifted coat. Cinematic litter. Did you see? Have you seen us do like this? Line the cupboards with old visas. Rim the stamps with teacups and wait for them to be upset by guests. Hold your breath. Stuff the walls with hair shorn for devotions. Save these coupons for coffins elsewhere. Press no hibiscus into old books and undo your face every night with metal and mercury. Drag your mothers out from the roots of your hair with bleach and heat. Nail your feet to the rails and suck the words from mouths like fillings clinking into basins. From them, smelt the metal and make eyes for your dead. Learn to stay wary of waves. Weave your teeth into a grin, stand in line, disappear in plain sight, hide a language like a wetness for the wrong one. Draw chalk lines between your children and ask them to call each other what you call your sister, your brother, and gather back the parts of their name every time they toss them on the streets, throw them in the trash, clean them letter for letter in the cold tub. Say yes, please, thank you, often, and with nodding. Never shake the head to me, yes or no. Never me, anything other. Count the old knees and buy the ointments in bulk to stave off a winter. tell the old knees the stories of their kneeling, the stories of their standing hard against the gallop of gunfire, the wallop of leather. Replace strings with buttons. Replace trains with cars. Replace food with fame. Fall a week to borrowed weather. Close the doors twice as often as you open them. Refuse the mailman his greeting. Rush at letters and make from the envelopes a small iron lung. Spin sugar from peaching light, but consider your neighbor the other neighbor's neighbor. Paint your fences with blood. Write of the dark ones on the white palms of the small things with henna, and glance at harvest moons. Hold a sieve up to view a husband's face meshed in DMV queues, consulate queues. Say you, say you, say we. Count the pieces of luggage. Count these reincarnations at Costco. Soap bottles and fill them with frying grease. Watch for nets, iron curtains with your burning books. Your walls wear two clocks, tell two times. Learn to love both enough to forget the difference when you call home where the arms point. Park the car like an unhinged gate. Borrow small sums. Soar your savings into the children's acronyms. MA, JD, MBBS, PhD, DDS, MBA, NRI, USA. Arrange the children in the closet. Make of their skin a resemblance to papers. Live off the fat of the landmine. Pull from your own elbows the twine to bind and hogtie yourself to a passerby. Sing their new national anthem into your own ear. Mourn your dead in letters. Bury your dead in the sky. Chename, let these eagles eat their hearts out. Let these eagles eat their hearts out. Just some tips. W's for Walt Whitman's soul. It sits with a fork made from a lotus on an ivory chair, eating an elfin steak in the company of bears and feral notch girls on a monsoon evening, incandescent with an appetite as mighty as railroads spanned across seas, and reclines, its cheeks burnished, its ass varnished by suns setting on bronze and sugared with saltpeter, its torso a tableau for the annals of rectitude, the theater for roiling or robust passage, a veritable Suez Canal towards missionary victories which thrust from such bejeweled and oiled loins anointed by coin, that emission of plump plums, lump sums into the Ganges, that coiling coy virgin maiden winding her languid locks, batting her lashes to its lashes, its spine, a gentle wire. supine. Its belly swells with salt and figs, with meat and treaties. It corks open a profound song. Itself it sings into books heavy with truths on the chair, dressed with leather and raw hides, kissed by ox blood, smeared with beef dung, lined with raw silk, woven from worms, plucked from boughs, basted across its pious, beaming eyes, its spidery, ghosted lids, and its Byzantine glance unmoors from its Chinese porcelain and crosses the ebony table, polished with lac secreted from the cloaca of the Kriolaka, set with glazed cakes, eaten by pinked mouths wearing crimson robes, to its guests, polished and glossed, and stained by the ooze, drawn to color, the uncolored raw linen, the wood, the human. Then, its wrist cuffed by gold and cowries, and studded with coral, draws a whisper-thin muslin veil, dyed carmine, sucked from crushed scale of cochineal, boiled in ammonia, and bled into curds, and rouge glinting, sanguineous and turbid, between bug and rug, snug a thug in a red coat or a turncoat, carrying urns of the stuff from estates of cocoa, coconut, calico across its face, while soft eclairs of chocolate bumble out from its plumed rump, choked with gum and linseed, flax and cassia, cinnamon and pepper, like so many lines of blood underwriting the mutton and not the goat, so it can sell them with a name of a place, like scarves or garlanded whores moored to wire of suckle by mother of pearl, or teas named after earls, and they, with whole scores to settle for homemade cures, nettles, ginger, turmeric, a paste, or to taste. And it steals and seals in letters scented with sandal, sent abroad, waxed and pressed with cornelian gems, honed from ground it owns, and makes stone from their flesh, ekes ink from their sweat, soaks indigo in lye fermented with time, and makes color so it can bid for its own passage, the passage of that soul to India. Thank you.